way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3841 after our Chaos Day yesterday. Yeah, once a month we have a Chaos Day. That's where I have John and Nicole on and let Nicole run the whole thing, and we just riff on a bunch of stuff. So even though we're on the second day of the week, it's kind of the first regularly scheduled programming of the week, and it is an interview day because it is a Wednesday, and that means we're about to have Hans Hagelman on with us in just a bit. He's going to be talking about how we can transform boys into non-brittle adults and into men. I mean, if you guys have listened to me for any length of time, you've probably heard me say more than once, as a parent, it is not your job to raise children. If you raise children, then you end up with an 18 or 20 year old adult child. That's not what we're looking to do. We're trying to raise adults. And if we can raise them in a resilient, non-brittle manner, so much the better. And there is a lot of things that are challenging today for parents and for mentors and uncles and aunts and godfathers and godmothers and grandfathers like me, et cetera, in doing that. And specifically, uniquely with young boys and transforming them into men. There has been what really looks and feels like a concerted effort to demasculinize society. And I don't think society can work that way. We can't merge everything together. Men have unique intrinsic characteristics that we bring to society as women do. And we both have unique roles in that. And I think we're going to talk a lot about that today with Hans today. Before we do, though, I would like to recognize our two sponsors of the day. And sponsor of the day number one today is Canine Academy. You can find that at canineacademy.us. Canine Academy is run by a good friend of mine, Joel Riles. Joel is where I actually got my dog, my Malinois Shepherd Cross, Belle, from. She's an amazing dog, and Joel is an amazing dog trainer. He trains some of the most advanced protection dogs that you can find anywhere in the world today. But you train a protection dog, and you train a bird dog, a homestead dog, a livestock guardian dog, etc. You might train them to do different things, but the method is the same. The three C's, right? Create, control, correct. That's how we condition a response with dogs. And the big problem most people have with dogs has nothing to do with the dog. It's all about the person. The dog is a reflection of its trainer and its owner, its partner humans. And you can learn to be the right type of partner human for your dog at canineacademy.us. There's a variety of courses you can choose from there. But you should get by there today. If you never have done this, you're like, oh, I should someday. Just do it. Go to canineacademy.us. Click on the problem-solving library. Sign up for that. It's completely free. See what it's all about, and then decide if you want to do more. Again, you can find the website at canineacademy.us, where you can figure out what your dog's superpower is. Next up today, another guy that I consider a good person. It's great to have sponsors that you look at and you go, these guys are actually my sponsors, but also my friends. That would be Anton Van Vuren at BiltongUSA.com. Anton immigrated legally right out of South Africa into the United States. He is a friend of liberty because he's seen what it looks like when you lose liberty in a country. And he started this really cool kind of import grocery store, cafe, little mini restaurant thing. Well, he did that right at the end of 2019. Well, you know what happened, right? A big old nasty, messy pandemic or scandemic, depending on how you think about it. And it basically shut society down for almost a year and a half, 2 years in a lot of places. And so what Anton did was immediately start looking at what can I ship that has the highest profit margin and the most demand and least competition. That was Biltong. So that's when he blew up the Biltong thing. And he makes some of the best, most authentic Biltong you'll ever try. It's amazing. Think of it sort of like jerky, but better. It's more like prosciutto made with beef is a way to think about it. But I also like the Biltong sticks. That's S-T-I-X. The Calabanazi sausages, the Drewers sausages, and all the cool import stuff that Anton has over at BiltongUSA.com. With that, I am excited to bring our special guest on stage right now. Hans, welcome to the Survival Podcast, man.
It's a thrill to be here, Jack. I briefly mentioned that you're kind of a hero of mine, and I don't fanboy over hardly anybody. But I've got emails going to you from 2011 when you were podcasting from your car. And my son was a big listener and still remains to this day a big listener. As a preteen, he grew up listening to you. He's even more conservative than I am. And every time he and I debate about politics, he goes, well, what does Jack say about this? So it's an honor to be here.
That's great. And when I got your app, I wasn't sure if you were out of our community or just someone that kind of saw what we do and thought there's a good fit. So it's always great, man, when you have a guest that has been around, especially for someone that's been around, you know, for over a decade. So I appreciate the fact that you've been part of our community that long, and I thank you for that, and I thank you for being here with us today.
Well, thank you. I mean, I got to add another piece to it. I learned about permaculture through you, took Jeff Lawton's online course, and a lot of the things talking about young men, as I see them, relate to some of the concepts of permaculture in terms of you know, return to the earth and surplus and care of people and care of earth. A lot of those things go into what I'm trying to do with young men.
Can we start off with, before we dig into what you're doing today, like how you ended up here? You have an amazing story from what I've read up on you. You grew up, I would bet, differently than just about everybody listening to you today. So can we kind of take it back to, we've got a young Hans, he's growing up, you know, he's probably in Dusseldorf, you know, skipping through fields or something with a name like Hans. But no, that's not the case at all. Where were you about the time you were like a preteen teen?
Yeah, preteen teen. Born in Chicago, but my parents came to New York really early. My father was a white man from a poor farming family in Nebraska. My mother came up with her family of 12 African-American in the Great Migration from the South. They fell in love. And my father started a residential drug treatment center in East Harlem. And that's where me, my brother and sister grew up. So, you know, we had our apartment above, and right below us was a dormitory with 60 guys just released from jail, prison, or coming back from the Vietnam War. And so those were our playmates, you know, at night. During the day, I was fortunate enough to be at a scholarship to a boys school that was founded in 1628 called the Collegiate School for Boys. And so I had a bit of a schizophrenic existence going from that school with people like John F. Kennedy Jr. Back to the place where all these guys were telling me about the hard times that got them to where they were.
So you grew up in this place that your parents founded, or your dad founded, called Exodus House, and you were surrounded by men who were trying to like rebuild their lives from addiction, incarceration, or maybe in the case of veterans, maybe some of that, maybe just pure trauma. That was a horrific war. And when they came home, they didn't get what they expected, like their fathers did from World War II, where they were welcomed home as heroes.
Right.
They were just kind of there. So it was a hard situation. What did the environment you were part of back then teach you about what men need to actually survive hard things? Because I would actually say the men of that era were probably more resilient, you know, in their 20s than the average 20-year-old is today. And yet they were facing some real hardship.
Yeah, no, there's no question that they were much tougher than the young people I'm surrounded by now. You know, one of the things my father tried to instill or bring into that space was the fact that there was always the opportunity for forgiveness, but that these men, and during the day women would come into the program, but that they needed to be belonging, and that was created in that community, but also a sense of purpose. You know, what are you here to do? You know, the world needs to be you've taken a lot from the world around you. You've taken a lot from your families. Now it's your turn to give back. And he did not play with that. I learned to all my profanity from the different meetings that I would hear him have with all these guys in the house. And he was loved and respected in the community, but he was also really hard. And he taught them that, you know, you've fallen, but, you know, you need to come back stronger through the stress and trauma that you've endured. And he wasn't coddling them, and he nor my mother coddled any of them. The staff that worked there didn't coddle these people. They were taught that you were not only going to become resilient, you know, in the words of Nassim Taleb, you're going to become anti-fragile. You're going to come back stronger based on what you've gone through.
Gotcha. You also, like, you're working in this same kind of space now, a little bit differently, but also trying to help develop young people into resilient adults. You have a pretty good educational pedigree. You mentioned a little bit of it with you had that scholarship as a kid, but that whole academic arc kind of continued for you. You had a legal career, and a legal career that a lot of people would gladly trade places with you for, to have that level of prestige, income, et cetera. And then you go and start a school back in East Harlem. And most people would see that as like a step down, income, prestige, all of it. What were you seeing in the justice system that made you feel like that's something that you needed to do?
Yeah, after the collegiate school, I went to Princeton, and then I went to Columbia University Law School. And, you know, I had always said that I was going to try to follow in my parents' footsteps. But when I got all those bills that I had to pay for school, yeah, and six figures of debt, I said, you know what? No, I'm going to have to figure this out with the law degree. And so I went to a prestigious firm that did mortgage-backed securities work, which at the time was useful. Okay. in the World Trade Center. Worked for a large, a really impressive real estate firm. And my mother said, well, what happened to saving the world? Are you doing that from where you are now? And it was embarrassing for her to even think about asking me that question. And so I asked my brother, who had graduated from Harvard in 3 years with high honors, but who was working as a janitor because he was trying to find his sense of place. And he'd become a teacher. And I said, look, what if we came back to the building where we grew up, and started a school? And at the time, my mother had developed severe Parkinson's. My father had a stroke that had paralyzed them, and they lived in a fourth floor walk up. And I wanted to keep them in their space. They weren't going to go to a home as long as I was around. And so the goal for that was to create a school in that building. So my brother said, if you can raise $50,000, I'll join you. Mm. And I had seen too many kids. I had been volunteering while I was practicing law, and in the schools I was working in, I would go into schools where kids were throwing chairs through windows, setting fire to the classrooms. I mean, it was a tough time in New York particularly. And I said, you got to catch these things upstream. And school was going to be the best way to do it. There were no charter schools back then. So we were going to have to raise money for this independent school. So my brother said, 50 grand, if you can do it, great. So I raised $25,000 from a family friend who was also a professional gambler. And then John F. Kennedy Jr., who had been a schoolmate of mine and whose path crossed with mine in the district attorney's office, said, I'm going to get you another 25 grand. And he kept his word and helped us raise money for the time that he was alive. And so we started with that. And I thought that was going to be the toughest part of yeah, doing the school. But this was also at a time where there were about 2,200 homicides in New York, mainly because of the crack epidemic. And so just so
this literally is this every, is like early 90s, late 80s.
That's right. Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Right.
And, you know, I didn't think I would have to navigate that. And I was used to the gunfire at least on a weekly basis, sometimes nightly. But what it turns out was the gang that ran the crack business in the neighborhood was upset with us for starting a school because it would bring more police presence and would cut down mm-hmm. on their business. So they took out a contract on my life and my brother's life. And I met with the police, and the local captain said, and to his credit, I appreciated his honesty, the police captain. He says, look, we've got a bigger, better armed gang, so we're going to try to support you, but you got to know the limits to how that works. He says, but we can also expedite a carry permit, and we can get you a discount on body armor. This is not something I thought I would need to do. And so in New York City, it's almost even back then, and certainly now, it's almost impossible as a citizen to get a carry permit. But they true to their word, I was able to get a carry permit within 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And because I had been in the Army Reserve, it's like, what am I going to carry? So I carried a Colt 1911, which was a pain in the ass to carry around when you're also trying to teach school or going to meetings where you're trying to raise money from
my favorite handgun. But I acknowledge a full size 19. I'm a FUD on the handgun thing, but I carry like a custom compact, you know, edges off 1911. But a full size like Rock Island Arms or something. Yeah, okay, I get you.
It was basic. It was basic. And so it was, is it partly that I also, some of the cops I had worked with as an assistant district attorney, they appreciated me and respected me. I boxed in a couple of benefit events for cops who had been shot and either paralyzed or killed. And so they appreciated that. I was the only non-police officer to box in those events. And so they put out, and again, it was interesting in terms of how race and class and all this other stuff works. So these cops, almost all of whom were white, went out into the community and said, anything happens to these brothers, you will find your people floating in the East River, which is a couple of blocks away. And then at the same time, I got a call from some black Muslims in the borough of Brooklyn who said, look, we know your father's white, but you're doing the job for our children. And we're going to put out the word that we are going to soldier in that community if they don't take the death threat off. So it was combination of these white police officers, the black Muslims, the fact that these guys knew I was armed, and they were, frankly, they were business people. And so they asked to set up a meeting with a guy who I had grown up with. I was a mentor to him. He happened to be a cop. His father was a Vietnam veteran. He raised four kids by himself. And they asked this one guy, this police officer, sergeant, to set up a meeting with the head of the family. And he said, what do you want? He says, there's too much pressure on us. It's hurting our business. And I said, you can't sell in front of our building. That's it. And you got to take the contract off. They took the contract off. Guys would come out of jail or prison and sell for them. And if they sold in front of the school because they didn't know any better, they would get a beat down from the gang.
Oh, wow.
Because they were honoring their word.
We have a treaty, bro. You need to go somewhere else.
Exactly. Exactly. And I had also had a white Irish cop who used to come out with his little scooter off duty every night for 3 months. And he said, if they're going to get you, they're going to get me too. And the courage of this guy to just do that. So these were all those lessons, right? And some of those lessons needed to be imparted to the young people. And the young people in the school, they saw what was going on. Their families knew that I was armed. They were okay with it because they knew that I was also protecting their children and not just my life and my family. So you had those kinds of honest conversations. And that work carried over. 30 plus years later, my brother is still running the school. The neighborhood is much calmer now. I hope it stays that way. But I had gone into work with other different populations. I moved to the Hudson Valley of New York State because I wanted my two youngest kids to see some grass and not just concrete and all that. And again, with the firearms piece, I moved up there, and within a week, somebody had burned a cross onto our lawn as soon as we got there. So the next guy, the guy delivering the oil, I said, look, I said, I'm an armed citizen and I intend to protect my family. I said, what do I need to do so we don't have to have this discussion get heated with the community? He goes, well, you could join the volunteer fire department. And I said, that's it? He goes, oh, yeah. He says, if you join the volunteer fire department, everything is going to be fine. So that's what I did. I was the oldest recruit in the academy, made it through. We never had a problem. I loved my time in the Hudson Valley. And as part of the work that I did in the Hudson Valley, I went to a place called Goshen Secure Center, which is a maximum security prison for teenage boys who've been convicted in adult court of extremely violent crimes. And I wanted to start a program there. And I was told by the administrators there, don't ask these boys what they have done because you will never come back. But I created a program. And again, thinking about the permaculture piece, one of the things that I did was we created vegetable gardens there, created vegetable gardens. We did mindfulness and breath work. And I tried to do yoga. But the kids said, one of these kids said, he took me aside and he said, unless you come back next week as a 20-year-old Asian woman in spandex, we don't want to learn yoga. I'm like, fine. So we had a calisthenics class. We did the vegetable growing. I had a kid from MS-13 drop down in the soil. I didn't know what he was doing, but all of a sudden he started making the equivalent of snow angels, except these were soil angels in the dirt. And he says, this reminds me of my grandfather's land back in El Salvador. There was another kid, same kind of deal. He said, this reminds me of my grandfather's place in Georgia. Just putting their hands in the soil, these boys, it changed them. Just doing the breath work, they take me aside and say, I have a lot of back pain. I get headaches at night. And I knew what that was. That's because of the trauma they were carrying from the bad things that they had done. But yeah. They would do the breath work in their cells at night, and that would improve them and help them. And so all of those lessons have brought me to where I am now, which is continuing that work. I'm in the Mississippi Delta now, which is a whole nother story. But I'm going back to New York to do work in both city jails and then state jails. And I'm going to try to get to other states with the work.
Yeah, when you were doing that, I've met people like you're talking about, people with really bad backgrounds. I mean, they did some things that, like, you're talking to this person and you're talking to another human being, and they're behaving like another, like a normal everyday human being. And when they're younger than you, you kind of have like this feeling of empathy for them that they're in a bad situation. And when you find out some of the things that they did, it's really, really bad. Like, we don't need to explain it, but most people understand what we're talking about. But I found that a lot of those people seem to me like, and I know there's always some that are playing, they're running game, right? Like,
right,
this
right.
Top story, whatever. But a lot of them that I've talked to, it seems like this is a person that was born into or moved into a bad situation. They didn't have a lot of support. They ended up finding people they could align with, and then that progressed into really bad things. They went along right. with the crowd, and I'm not excusing. I'm saying that is what happened. And it seems like a lot of these people can be pulled out of that, and with schools like you're talking about, prevented from going into that. In all these discussions, what did you figure out these people maybe needed that no one was ever giving them?
You know, you're right. Some of them come out of the factory broken, and so then, you know, what do you do? But yeah. The ones who don't, they got caught up in things on the worst day of their lives, and none of us wants to be caught doing something on the worst day of our lives. These kids, because of their prefrontal cortex and what they were surrounded by, that was an extreme. But just having a grown male telling them about right and wrong. I was back there a couple of months ago, and I was talking to these kids about what do they value, what, you know, and so they were coming up, of course, with the money and the guns and the girls and all this other stuff. And so yeah. We had to talk about that. I said, well, you see where all that got you, right? You're here, and you're going to be here till you turn 21, and then you're going to go upstate to an adult prison for another 10 or 15 years in some cases. So tell me how that's been working for you. So then we talked about some other things. And I talked to them a little bit about my life and some of my challenges being married twice and stuff like that. And they appreciated the openness. And then one kid finally said, he goes, you know, when I finally get out of here, he goes, I want to make sure I protect my woman. Right now, if I go in certain circles in New York City, they would say, oh, that's whatever. Right. The patriarchal and this, that, and the other yeah. In that facility. That's exactly what I needed to hear. And he got it exactly right. And he said he would do whatever he had, and he would take – it's a big, strong kid. He's like 19 yeah. years old. He was like 6'2", 230 pounds. And he says, nobody's ever going to touch my woman or her family or my family. I'm going to protect them the way I protected myself when I was out. And so just seeing that little bit of glimmer in terms of his movement, that's where I wanted him to do. But it's also the purpose. They need to have a sense of purpose. And you talk to these kids, who's going to teach them that? And they're not the men in their lives in those communities, unfortunately. And I've been in poor white communities. You know, my son was working in West Virginia for a while. And I'm here in Mississippi and poor black communities. And it's the same kind of thing. If you don't have strong male role models who are prepared to be active in their lives, they're going to divert to whoever's got the loudest voice and the scariest presence.
Yeah. And
they need to know that it's okay to want to support and help their communities. And when they understand that that's also part of masculinity, that's where they move into it. And so I'm trying to talk with the city and state and negotiate. And fortunately, I've run into some deputy or assistant commissioners who are open to this. And so I've talked with the boys. I said, look, I'm going to get you certified as a breathwork coach. So because they do the CBT, the cognitive behavioral therapy and all the talk therapy, and it has its place. But until they know where the trauma lives in their bodies and how they deal with that and how they, you know, there's a stimulus and mm-hmm. then there's a response. And that quote says, you know, in that space between stimulus and response is where all our freedom lies. And if we make the wrong choice in there, we got problems.
Yeah.
So the breathwork helps them figure out the best choices between that stimulus mm-hmm. and response. I got somebody who works, who's a co-founder of something called World Central Kitchen that was formed by Chef Jose Andres. And they go to all the hot spots around the world and they do community feeding. And I'm telling these boys, I said, if you're out, when you're out, I said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to the breathwork coaching certification. You're going to take become a mental health first aid certified teacher. You're going to become a drone pilot. You're going to learn how to cook. And some of these boys cook because that's what guys do. But you, right, you and I both know what an important survival skill that is.
It's an important skill in prison, by the way. Like I listened to this cooking show, and they had a dude on that had been in prison for like 11 years before he got out, and he was talking about all the creative ways that they cooked in prison. So there should be at least some level of something going on there.
Well, absolutely, and it's even more of a challenge with teenage boys because they'll figure it out when they get to the adult prison. But the ones who are going to get out as teenagers, they have no clue that cooking their food and so forth gets them beyond where you know their peers are. And so, but when you have those conversations with them, they look at you, they look at me, they're like, oh, these are real men who actually know how to prepare food and you know, create their own, you know, buy their own vegetables or create their own vegetable gardens or, you know, feed a community. And it appeals to them because they want a sense of purpose. The drone piece. Well, I was trying to do it down here in Mississippi, and there were certain roadblocks to that, but I won't get into that, for medical drone delivery. And when you talk to these boys about medical drone delivery, they're into it. And the problem with a lot of schools is, you know, a lot of these charter schools or other, they talk about their scholars and they say, our scholars are going to do this. Our scholars learn that. Not every kid wants to be a scholar. Not every kid should be a scholar. Some of them just want to be people with meaning and purpose who are giving back. And in terms of healing, if they can give back just even a portion of what they took from their communities, that's going to make everybody that they're involved with going further. And I said, look, you don't have to go back to that environment that you were in. If you know how to cook and feed a community, if you know how to do both mental health first aid and regular first aid, if you take the FEMA course for certified emergency response training, which I've done with young people before and they love it, if you can go and go to something like Boulder Outdoor Survival School and learn to survive on your own, I said, you can, if you learn how to grow vegetables, you can go into any community around this country and become someone who's valuable and leave that other story behind. And they get that.
Yeah. You know, when you're talking about the guy that said he's going to take care of his woman, that gave me a weird visual, I think, that most people would think at first. And like, I'm sure you've dug some holes in your life and you dig that hole and that big rock's in that hole and you can't really get a bite on it. And you keep working. And finally you get a little tiny piece of it. You can get the shovel under and you pull back on that shovel and that rock, it doesn't come out right away, but moves a little bit. And once it moves a little bit, you get something to work with, and you know you're going to be able to get it out of that hole, right? That's how that kid sounded to me, because the minute he says that, you can say, that's a great goal, and I think you should do that. Let me ask you a question. If you screw up again and end up back here, how are you going to do that? Right? Because at that point, now I can get you thinking about something that motivates you, not me. Now you told me what you wanted, and I've figured it out. For you to be able to do that, you're going to have to walk a straight enough line that you don't have to do this ever again, because if something happens to that person right now, what are you going to do about it? Be mad?
Right.
Shake the bars? Yell at your cellmate? Punch somebody in the face? None of that's actually going to help that person. So you've got that little claw hold now, and now you can begin to extract from that person who they really are instead of the facade they built around them to protect themselves and the environment that they're in. And exactly, I imagine in all the work you've done, everyone that's been a success, you got that claw hold somewhere, and it was probably always different.
It's always different, and sometimes you they'll interact with you, and you still won't even know till later. I had one kid who he had a couple of bodies on him, and I got a call from the administrator, the head administrator. He says, "Can you come in and speak to so and so?" And I said, why? The guy has hardly anything to say to me. He says, well, he's injured two staff members and he's in solitary right now. He's refusing to eat and speak. And he says, you're the only person he'll speak to. And there was no clue, but there was something in our conversations before that, you know, that little bit of leverage point that you're talking about that got him to see that. And so we had, you know, I wasn't necessarily comfortable being locked up in a cell because he didn't want anybody in the cell when he and I were talking.
Yeah.
Which could have caused problems, but the conversation worked out. There was that leverage point. I think he actually was able to get out, not necessarily solitary confinement, but his they didn't add any time to his incarceration term in the facility because he cleaned his act up after that point. And so you never know. I brought my son there, who I told you listens to a lot of survival podcasts, and I use him as an example with some of these kids. And clearly my son is very clean cut. It helps that he's like 6'3", 225 pounds and works out, right?
Yeah.
But they want to know about his – and so he did everything right. He went to University of Virginia. He went to – he's at William & Mary in business school. He's the head of the MBA association there. He cannot get a summer internship job. And I was telling these boys that. And they said, so what is he going to do? And what he's going to do is he's going to be working as a wildland firefighter this summer in South Dakota.
Huh.
Because he's not going to sit around. I mean, and he knows that. And I don't have the resources to provide him with whatever. But again, it's that anti-fragile piece. All right, you did everything right, and you can either feel sorry for yourself, or you're going to make something of this. And I think having that on his resume will do him much more in terms of whatever career he does than crunching numbers as an analyst at some Wall Street firm. And so these boys listen to that.
Back when I was in the corporate world, if I was hiring somebody like that and I'm down to two candidates and one's done something like that and the other one's done nothing with their summers other than sit around because they couldn't get an internship, I know who I'm hiring.
Right.
It's not even a competition at that point.
Yeah. And so they hear that those things are possible, but they don't. I mean, it's amazing. Whether it's the kids that I had at my independent schools, because they had hard times. They had, with one exception, I had one kid who was there for 3 months, and then he said I was too tough, and he left. Subsequently got locked up, and he's doing federal time for gun running. But he also was able to get access to a device where he I think it's since been taken away, where he was communicating with me on Facebook and said, I didn't appreciate all the things that you were showing me back then. He said, and he felt vulnerable enough to say, I had no men in my life other than men doing bad things. He says, you were the first man who was doing something right. He said, I remember we went to Maine and we were doing the canoe trip and we did it for a week. I thought I was going to die. He says, that was tougher than anything I've had to deal with here in the federal penitentiary. He says, my only regret was not going on that work project to Nicaragua. He says, I have to admit, I was scared about that, right? This is a guy who's gun running.
Yeah, I got you.
But who didn't have any type of connection. And there are too few men willing to step out, unfortunately, to make that connection. And I get it for a variety of reasons, but there are too few men willing to do it.
Can we talk a little bit about the difference between anti-fragility and resilience? I'm going to tell you that if you say a person who can survive being incarcerated in a serious penitentiary is not resilient, you don't know what they're going through. Like, those people are resilient. They're not necessarily any fragile, though, because it was a fragility that actually put them on a course that ended them up there. So can we kind of talk about the juxtaposition between those two things?
Yeah, so the way I think about it is that, if something breaks, it clearly was fragile. If you're resilient, you come back to baseline. And it's like, okay, what's next? But if you're anti-fragile, whatever stress, trauma, bad stuff has happened in your life, you say, you know what, I'm going to take that and use that as fuel to become even better and to get to the next level. And I don't care. And I've seen young men do that, but they have to have a vocabulary for it. Mm-hmm. They have to know they're not alone when they do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I view those three distinctions: fragile, resilient, and anti-fragile.
Gotcha. You kind of mentioned on like no men in their lives and whatever. And through this whole conversation, I've been thinking, and I know you've listened a lot, but I don't know if you've ever heard me talk about the elephant story. But it just makes me think of that. So many problems in our youth, especially our young men. But there was this time in history after they went kind of over the top with cropping elephants and then the ivory hunters on top of that, taking all the old elephants out and leaving the young. we ended up with these young juvenile, and when I say a juvenile elephant, you're talking like 20-year-old male elephant, like going into villages and like picking people up and smashing them against and just tearing shit yep. up like a violent gang. And yep. they couldn't figure out why, because this had there's always been friction between elephants and humans in places where elephants live, but overall this was not a thing. And then right. like conservation came back in, the herds began to age out. The old males, you know, we started having young males actually growing the old males again, and the bachelor herd phenomenon recurred, where all the males kind of leave the girls in the calves for a period of time every year, and they kind of go off on their own like a little retreat, and it's the old men and the young boys. Right. And when the youngins start to, you know, cause a ruckus, doing like the old men basically will whack them and like, hey. We don't do yep. that shit, right? Like when you go in that, yep. that village, they're smart enough to know, and you provoke that, they come out and kill us. And we don't want that shit, so you need to knock it off, not just amongst humans, but against themselves and surrounding. And then all of a sudden, everything just leveled back out. And that is really frightening if you look at the way, especially in inner city environments, that young yes. men behave today. They're completely fragile, but they're also very violent. And it looks very similar to me.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the concept of this phenomenon of drill rap is it makes my head spin. These kids are killing each other over drill rap. And you talk to some of these kids, they're going out and they're surrounded by other young men their age because these guys are the only frame of reference. They've got the gun. The other kids around them know they're willing to use it. So they're the organizing factor in those communities, because other men, the grown men, either just aren't around or aren't willing to step up and say, you know what? No, we're here. And there are programs like F3, which I guess is what Fellowship, Faith and Fitness, where they, you know, bring men together and it's Christian based and they do workouts and talk about the challenges that they're facing, right? If you don't have anything like that where the grown men are handling their issues, they're certainly not going to have that capacity to work with the young kids. And it's you know, the statistics on the number of young men in terms of suicide rates and deaths of despair or not even going to college, which isn't necessarily a great measure, but it still shows the disparity in terms of community, in terms of, but if in New York, if we were talking like this in New York City, we would be seen as, again, right, they would use all the words, patriarchy and all this other stuff, right? I get on Zoom calls where they say, well, how come you don't have your pronouns on the screen? And luckily I get to say, because I'm in the Mississippi Delta, and if I use my pronouns, I would be lynched, right? They don't, we don't do pronouns down here in Mississippi, right? And so they're like, oh, okay, because they don't know anything about this place.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't know
yeah.
anything about this place. But yeah. but there are no men themselves don't have, I mean, friendships among men, right? They just yeah. don't happen, which is why some of the initiatives that you undertake are so critical and important. But if I were to find the equivalent in New York State for the kind of thing that you're doing, or the person who's organizing that stuff, it'd be incredibly hard to find. The firefighters that I was around, that was one place, but that was in the Hudson Valley. If you yeah. talk about the inner city in New York, like Newburgh, or Harlem, or the South Bronx, you're not going to find those support groups, because the grown men themselves don't have their own support system. So they certainly don't have the nervous system regulation to provide it to the young boys coming up in their wake.
You know, I think part of the problem too is a lot of people just look at it, well, they're bad or whatever, like, because yeah. well, I don't behave that way, so they should. And so much of this is situational to a degree. I'm not going to remove the penalty for committing a violent crime against somebody. That's your cross to bear if you do it. But I also understand how people get into this environment. And when you really look into some of the places you're talking about, if you can imagine yourself being born there and then somebody telling you, well, just fix your life. It's way easier said than done. And the person you're speaking to, especially if they're very young and they haven't fully cognitively developed yet, they can't even see that it's possible. Right.
Right.
And what it makes me think of a little bit is about, I guess, 10 years ago, there was a huge tornado that hit Alabama. And my wife and I that year, we drove to Florida and we ended up driving right along the state highway where it crossed, and it was about a 3/4 mile wide tornado. And it reminded me of the miniseries in the '80s, The Day After, about nuclear war. I mean, look in both directions, all you could see was just buildings leveled to the ground. And if you told somebody fix that, they would stand there and stare and go, I don't even know where to start. And I think a lot of these young people in their lives, they feel that way about where they live, their like everything in their life feels like that. Like, you tell me to do something, but I don't even know step one. And that's why I think maybe it's simple things like gardening, breath work that you're talking about. Like, you give that person one thing they can actually do. You know, you're kind of in Jordan Peterson's world of like, fix the sock drawer. Like, just anything, because otherwise there's just nothing. And the only thing that seems to work is probably the worst choice you can make. Hook up with the boys and start flinging some smack or something, right? That at least gets me some money in my hand, but that money, of course, and that life never lasts. So I got to do more to get, and so it feels like progress, but it's really regressive. And they're sitting in this place where that's the only thing that looks like progress, and it's regressive. And so when people just only look down on that, I think that we're so missing the actual problem.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, as I said, what's interesting for me, having been in places like New York or the people that I was going through my military training with, you know, went to Fort Campbell, Kentucky for my air assault training and all this other stuff, or being here in the Mississippi Delta, it crosses, you know, racial lines. And one of the things I got pushback from here in Mississippi was trying to get some of the black teens and the white teens together to put together an emergency response effort. And also something to deal. I live in a place that's known as Murder Valley and Tornado Alley, both. And there were people at foundations who knew that if I was able to fund me to put together this initiative with these white teens and black teens, that first of all, it would be incredibly successful, and these boys would learn about one another, and that they had a lot of more things in common than they had realized. But at the same time, that also becomes a danger to certain people if these young people, you know, particularly at the lower end of the economic spectrum, are working together. A lot of people don't want to see that, and I found that out the hard way here.
It's amazing how much of that is entrenched. I think that's entrenched more than the typical innate racial racism that people invoke. It's more about people that are above it in a logistical standpoint, but benefit from it. And they don't want the problem solved, because they've built a solution that doesn't solve the problem. They built a solution that derives income from the problem. And now you're a threat to their industry rather than somebody that's actually trying to fix a problem. That's how they view it.
Well, I hate to use the word, but that is triggering for me, because that's one of the reasons I'm leaving Mississippi. I came down here to turn around a community center started by some Catholic nuns, and I did that. And all of a sudden, the violence in the community stopped. I had people coming out helping when there was a flood in the gym. They would come out and help. I would pick up a group of boys. I'd make two trips in this town where you just didn't go to this town if you weren't from it, because you would get shot and robbed, right? But these kids knew I was there for them, and so they actually asked me to run for mayor at one point. And I brought in the University of Mississippi to teach a classics program. And I was told by my board members, who happened to be three of them, white, one was a lawyer, one was an investment banker, and they came from very well-to-do families, and they also identified as liberals. They were very liberal, and they were very involved in the civil rights work down here. They told me, these people here, this is how they phrase it, these people, they will not understand you wanting to teach them about Shakespeare or Epictetus or Marcus Aurelius or any of the classics, Sun Tzu. They're not going to want to know about any of that. And I said, just shut up and let me do what I'm going to do.
Yeah,
this is a town of 1,200 people. I had 60 kids showing up 3 weekends in a row for 4 hours to learn about the great philosophers of ancient Greece and Rome and all that. And they were into it. These kids were into it. And I got pushback from these board members saying, well, this is not what these kids are supposed to be playing basketball. This is not why we brought you down here. It then only became worse when they got $1 million for a civil rights site down here. they bought a property, a broken down barn for $1 million that was paid for by a Hollywood celebrity. And I said to these same board members, I said, because they were working on another nonprofit, I said, why would you do that when these kids need jobs, when they need training? I said, they're going to be, you know, truck driving jobs are going to be gone in 10 years because of AI and self-driving vehicles. I said, you know, help me with the drone delivery thing. Help me with the drone spraying here on the agricultural fields, which would have been huge. Yeah. And they said, no, they wanted to engage in what's called, right, to your point. Well, it's dark. Oh, absolutely. The drone piece. But they wanted to stay in what's called dark tourism or thanatourism, where they wanted to just continue to relive what they felt were the travesties of the civil rights era and all that. But you talk to the people here, they say, no, we've lived through that. We want to make our lives better. But there's nobody carrying that message. And it's the same thing for these teenage boys.
Well, if you build an industry on helping people who are held back due to race and you fix the problem, your industry goes away. Right. People get crazy when I say this, but the most racist demographic in the United States today are wealthy white liberals.
Yes.
That is
100%
true. The cleanest in the trailer park down the road 5 miles from me does not even begin to even come close to the level of that level of racism. That here's a person showing that they'll try, and you say, no, they can't do that.
It is reprehensible, and I'm glad I'm still in Mississippi because I get to tell my northern friends exactly that piece of it. I had the last white mayor of the town where I was working. He came in, he put his boots up on my desk, and it was my first month there. I'm like, oh, what is this guy? He has a Confederate flag in the back of his truck along with his two firearms, you know, prominently displayed. And he says, don't go into this particular town. I said, why not? He says, because color killed colored. He says, and unless you got your gun, he says, they're going to get you first. Now, a lot of people would say, oh, aren't you a fan? I said, no, this guy was actually trying to look after my safety. And so I spoke to him, and his sister runs the liquor store in town. And she says, thank you for being here. She goes, because a lot of people, she says, they claim that we're connected with the Klan. She says, we aren't. She says, but we also don't like, she says, this is a mainly black town where there's a lot of crime. She says, and you're the first person that has come in here and brought the statistics down because you're telling these kids how they're supposed to conduct themselves and that they have a brighter and better future. And she says, without a brighter and better future, she says, nothing's going to happen for them. She goes, I would tell that to the white trash in my community is what she said, this white woman, right? And so being able, people don't want to have those conversations. And that's it. And I'm 68 years old, and my motto is to become an ancestor worth remembering. So I kind of feel like I'm in a race right now. And so that's, again, why I appreciate you having me on for this, because I don't get to vent like that. And I'm sorry for venting, but it causes me tremendous anger.
One thing I want to roll back to, because if I don't, I'm going to go down that for another hour, because it is infuriating, and I've seen many examples of it. But the breathwork thing really interests me. You kind of brought that into a prison system, and you had benefit with it. What was it about that, and how did it actually work and make a difference?
Well, there are a couple things. Before I had left from Mississippi, I had also done some work with the Veterans Administration. And particularly during COVID, there was a lot of despair among veterans in my area. And I committed to putting myself to be of value, which is what I try to tell these kids that I work with, no matter what. And so breathwork was something I took up. I had been doing breathwork, but in a more yogic way for years, for decades. But there's a person named Dr. Belisa Vranich, who works with law enforcement and military. And she, her stuff is performance breath work. So I work with her and a guy named Patrick McCune, who does it mainly for sports. And so I got certified in those areas. And knowing that, you know, this is performance breath work, it's not the spiritual stuff that some people get turned off by, that I would then be able to work with these boys and say, no, this is going to help you with the pain that you're feeling. It's going to help you with your workouts. And when you get angry, it's going to help you to calm down before you get put in solitary. And they got all of that. Mm. And the other piece was it, and to New York State's credit, because again, as you know, dealing with bureaucracies can be hellish. they agreed to allow me to certify these kids as breathwork coaches, which is insane. Like, it's insane. But part of it was, if I told these boys we're just going to do breathwork, I'd still get the pushback. But if I said, no, you will be certified and you can take that to an employer, you could take that to a community center when you get out and say, hey, I'm back and this is what I have to offer the young people here. Then they said, oh, okay, we'll send. What techniques do we need to? So they had to do the techniques in order to get certified. And then once they would get the techniques, they would take me aside and say, I don't want to tell anybody else about this, but it's really helping me. I don't have the same kind of nightmares. The pain in my shoulder's gone. I find myself smiling more. Nobody seems to know why. And so getting that feedback was critically important. I saw the work clearly that it had for the veterans I was working with. And I also do something called EFT, emotional freedom technique, tapping, which these boys also seem to take, and they know they can, you know, do it in their cells at night when they're by themselves, and they're going to get the benefits that'll show up fairly quickly.
I think most of the people that come out of the prison system and do something with their lives, and they got into some form of self-improvement while they were there. There's kind of two paths. There's the rot and the grow. Right. And that's the path, I think, for everybody, but it's magnified in that environment. And a lot of them, maybe if they look like they're improving because they get into working out and shit and they get jacked. But the reason they're doing that is because, one, they're bored, and two, they want to make sure nobody can you know, shank them to death or something.
Right.
So they're trying to become a badass so they can defend themselves. It's the other path. The people that pursue a GED and then become a teacher and a mentor and help others do that if they eventually get out, they go do something. And I think part of that is just self-worth. You don't have any self-worth at all in you if you can't say, I want to be better than I am. And I believe that when you look to everybody else like you're doing great, if you're not trying to be more, you don't have self-worth. If you're in prison, you kind of got to admit somewhere along the way you fucked up. Okay. Like, you can't be like, hey, my life is great. So the person that's in that situation really should be trying to work on themselves. And I think maybe one of the reasons the breath work works is, one, just it does work. It does have biochemical, physical changes in the body and psychological changes in the body. But it also is, okay, now I've given you the carrot. This might benefit you when you get out. You can have maybe some income, a start with it. But two, now you're working on you and you start to see improvement in yourself. You start to value yourself. Because I would bet that you would agree that maybe if you said the top three things that people need in their lives in that situation, one is to value themselves. I'm not sure it's number one, but it's got to be top three.
Yes. Yes. Well, they can't take care of anybody else unless they're taking care of themselves. And I had to learn that early on in my time when I was running the school and walking around with my Colt 1911, right? It's like, you got to find a way to regulate your nervous system. Otherwise, you know, the marriage, your work with the kids in the classroom, your donors, none of that's going to work. So I learned those lessons early on. And you're absolutely right, that value, because again, as I mentioned, some of these kids are going to get out at 18 or 21, but some of them are going to be in for another 10 or 15 years at the adult facility. And you've got to give them some kind of anchor. And I've got a son and three daughters. I don't want them coming out, these guys coming out 10 years from now, and my children having to deal with that. You know, that selfishly is the other reason why I do the work, you know. But the kids, they always want to test you. When I got there, they said, one kid said, we know why you're not afraid of us. This is after they allowed me to stay with the boys outside, because the staff would never allow them outside after dark. And they eventually allowed me with one staff member to take like 8-9 boys out after dark. What these boys wanted to see, they wanted to see the birds flying across the horizon. They wanted to see the sunset. They wanted to see the stars come up. They weren't out there trying to figure out how to shank me, right? They they showed that trust. And I said, so why do you think I'm not scared? This is because you did a lot of time in prison. I was like, I don't know what kind of energy I'm giving off. I have never done a day in prison, but thank you. And they said, well, how come you're not? I said, if you beat me up successfully, you will get additional time added to your sentence. I said, but if this 60-plus-year-old man beats you up, I said, that will follow you to your next facility, and you will be embarrassed and you will never live it down. I said, so it doesn't make sense. I said, but number three, I don't intend to lose. I said, so all three of those reasons are why you're picking that energy up. And they appreciated that I was honest with them about that, you know?
Yeah, I think part of it is that because you do breadth work, because you grew up with this mindset of trying to help people, because you had parents that were in that space, because you've worked with them so much, you're able to maintain what we call a parasympathetic state, which yes. means that you are in a response, not a react mode, where most people walk around their whole lives in a sympathetic neural state, which means they're in fight, flight, or freeze. And probably a lot of right. these people you're dealing with, that's how they're like, if I was in prison, I'd probably spend a lot of time in a sympathetic neural state, wondering if somebody's coming up Absolutely. Behind me or something like that. So when a person that's always in that state gets around a person and they're just chill and they're direct and they're tough, but they don't get overreactive, it's almost viral in a positive way, where some of that energy starts to move into them. And they come down and they're like, well, if he's chill, then I need to be chill. And I know some of these people, they've only been in like juvenile institutions and all, but the ones that have gone on and served, you know, with adults alongside them, one of the things they're going to have kind of drilled into them, if they never had respect for old men, they're going to get it real freaking fast right. in the joint because right. the old dude that's been in there for 25 years and he's gray haired and all, and he kind of looks after everybody and his mobbing days are behind him or whatever. That dude is respected. And when he says knock it off, right. it gets knocked off. So you also kind of have that maturity that if you were in the joint, you would have that kind of, hey, don't, you know, don't Absolutely. Do that. You know,
no, you're right. And they pick that up. I mean, as well as for staff, the co-regulation that you're talking about,
yeah,
some of the smarter administrators know that if their staff is in that same parasympathetic state, that yeah. that's also going to impact what's going on in the facility as well. Because these, and again, some of the maximum security institutions for teens are understaffed, and so I get why there's that fear.
Sure,
but, you know, the staff has to regulate their own nervous systems. Otherwise, that, as you say, is going to play out into the residents there.
Yeah, I mean, you can take a room full of people that are just normal, everyday people, and if you just put one, like you just a psycho experiment, and you sent one guy into a waiting room, and everybody else doesn't know what's going on, and he just starts like acting sketchy, then pretty much everybody starts looking at him, and then eventually they start looking at each other, then they start looking at the door, like what's going on here, because that behavior seems on edge, and so
right.
you put that into an institution, and it gets hyperized. So, yeah, right. I mean, the right. more stability you can bring, the better. I also want to talk about this concept. Like, we kind of danced around this, but what do you think most people get wrong about the cause and the solution to these problems?
I think again, they're different things. Like, so here in the Mississippi Delta, I live in a town called Rome. And people okay. love it. Rome. Oh, no.
Rome, I know where
Rome is. Mississippi. yeah. There's nothing here. Right. And in the absence of that, people default to the same kind of survival instincts that we're talking about. It's fight, flight, or freeze. And you see it. I see it here in this town that I'm in every single day. And it goes back to, again, that Thana or dark tourism. If the only money coming in is for tourists to come see where something happened bad to somebody else, that's not going to do anything for the residents here. And so what are you going to default to? Solutions, I think it was interesting. I was talking to some of these boys and I said, look, I would not want to trade places with you. I said, but you do have one advantage in terms of being here for a few years compared to your peers on the outside. I said, and you're probably not going to guess what that might be. What do you think it is? One boy actually knew. He goes, we don't have access to social media. I said, exactly. I said, and once you get out, you need to maintain that social media diet, perhaps not as extreme as it is here where there's none.
Yeah.
I said, but your brains, you know, whatever went wrong when you committed what you committed, your brains still have not been damaged to the extent that so many young people who won't commit the crimes that you committed, but are still going to live lives of despair or irrelevance because they have defaulted to social media. And so, you know, that's where the relationships are formed, whether it's a dating app or a porn site or a gambling site. I mean, that's where everybody's attention goes. And so you have people defaulting to that. If you have men who aren't forming real friendships amongst themselves, You've got no leadership in training to work with the young people coming after them. And so social media plays a huge role in this. And in terms of how do you regulate it, get a handle back on it. If you have people who think that learning about ethics and morality, like the people down here who were against my teaching classics to the kids here, if you don't have people understanding that ethics and morality are incredibly important lessons, that all you're supposedly doing is preparing kids for the world of work when none of us knows what that's going to look like in a couple of years, you're making a mistake. And these kids are left floundering with no relationships, no connection to anything other than their social media. And that ends up going in a bad way. I've one of the things that I'm trying to do with these boys who are incarcerated, who are going to be the ones who are going to get out sooner, is to get them to sell photo magnets. I didn't even know, but photo magnets are a huge business. And so you go to a college reunion, you go to a wedding, you go to some family event, reunion, or whatever else, and you get them with $800 of equipment and printing stuff to create photo magnets. I was watching a couple of people, one from Utah, the other's from Oregon, and they're doing six figures with photo magnets. So, you know, figuring out how do you make these boys useful? They want to learn, they want to earn money, right? So there have to be ways to do that. It's going to be even harder to do that in the world of AI. And so I'm looking at things as simple as photo magnets. I'm looking at something as simple as if they're doing feeding the community through the training that hopefully they're going to receive from the World Central Kitchen, that they then have some value, that those jobs aren't going to be immediately replaced. But they need to know that they're going to be making money. They need to have role models. Schools need to stop talking about the scholars that they're educating and say, how are we going to teach our young people to work in this world? I've had to teach myself, and I look at the course that you have, I've had to teach myself about AI, and I've got apps that I've got a charter school network looking for their staff. Princeton's graduate student government recognizes I have a personal coaching app that's going to do that. I want to teach these boys getting out how to do that, as well as using the app for those times, because it doesn't scrape ChatGPT or anything. There's a certain body of work that I've used throughout the years that I think is really good, that these boys can use as their own personal coach for their times where they can't reach an adult male figure or somebody who's going to regulate them. So they need to learn about how the world of AI, but in a good way. And they need to figure out how they're going to make a living when they come out.
Have you noticed how many of these guys that are in the joint, like they come up with these entrepreneurial things in there? Like, and some of them are incredibly talented. Like, I've seen people that just take all the slivers of soap and put it back together and make carvings and stuff. And you look at that and you go, if you had put half the effort into that spirit when you were on the outside versus the inside, you would have never went in there. You'd have been too busy being successful to end up there.
Yes.
And on your comments on education, I also look at this and I go, it's kind of weird because the school graduates this kid and they go off to college. It doesn't even matter where. And as long as they went to college, the high school says, we did good. We succeeded.
Right.
The other kid gets out with a C average. They look at that as a failure. He goes down the road, gets a job working at a welding fabrication factory. 5 years later, he's making $80,000 a year with a trailer out in the oil patch, welding stuff out in the oil patch, making $80,000 to $120,000 a year. And the kid that went to college but dropped out is schlepping lattes. And the school considers the one that's doing lattes a success because they graduated and went to college and had a good grade. And the one that's actually successful in life is a failure. And to me, we just have this massive inversion of reality. We're not judging success based on outcomes. We're judging success based on metrics that favor the institution that's using the metric. Like, it's we investigated ourselves and found that we did nothing wrong. It's the same pattern in a different place.
And that's why I get shut down by certain funders, because they're like, well, how are you going to track college outcomes? I'm like, I'm going to do that incidentally, but that's not a main focus. The populations that we're talking about, that makes no sense, both with the populations that we're talking about, but as I see with my own son, he's like, you know what? If I don't get into business, fine. He says, I'll figure it out. I'll join, I'll stay with the wildland firefighting. He says, I have applications into some oil fields. He goes, I'm going to make it work, right? And if that attitude that he has, I can bring to these young men. And so some of them think that they don't have a future if they don't go to college. And there are not enough people telling them you are completely wrong about that because society has another message.
Yeah. I mean, they're using the wrong, in the business space, we say the wrong KPI, right? The KPI for the people you're working for, if they never go back to prison.
Yes.
That's a gold star, right? If they obtain any sort of meaningful employment and stay gainfully employed doing something meaningful in their own life, not yours. That's a KPI. Those are the things that you look at for that group of people. And honestly, that's really the measure of success we should be having for everybody. I don't care what school you went to. If you went to a school that was really good because you have a path that needs that, then that is one of your KPIs. If you're a person who wants to come out in a blue collar trade and you end up really happy with your life, you raise good kids, you have a great family, you pass on a great legacy, what measure of success exceeds that? Because tons of people have the degrees, the certifications, the initials after their name, but they don't do any of that stuff.
That's right. Now, I have kids from my high school, an independent high school that I started. One guy who became a plumber. The other guy became a body worker. They're both making six figures. But I have funders pull away from me because these kids didn't go to college. I said that was never the intention. They're taxpaying citizens and they're both married. They're taking care of their wives. They're taking care of their children. You tell me. And I wanted to ask these funders, I know a little bit about your kids, right? With the millions of dollars. And I know that they are not creating surplus value in the world. So, but you can't go there. But yeah, I know.
Well, no, because what it is they've built their metric of their success on the fact that they went to a university and their children did and their grandchildren will and their grandchildren's children will. So that becomes their KPI in their life. And so they have a very hard time accepting that anybody could succeed without that.
Right.
And then that'd be the same person that would then turn around the next day and tell you, well, why are you bringing somebody in from a university to talk to these people about Shakespeare and the classics and strategic thinking and Stoic philosophy? Because they can't do that. So then you're just like, so basically what you're saying is you don't want me to do anything at all except monkey shine this thing and put a couple kids in college and say, look what not I did, but look what the donor did. Right. That's really what the message for that person is.
That's right. That's right.
Can you give me a couple examples I can point to and put my name on a building and say I made that happen? Not I actually want to fix the problem. Because if I benefit from them, it's like asking the drug company to cure a disease. They're not going to do it.
Right. That's right.
Pfizer's been in business for like 117 years. Zero cures. Zero cures in 117 years.
Right.
Most successful drug company arguably on the planet. Never cured a disease.
Yep. But it's why I don't get invited back to those fancy schools that I attended because they don't understand that construct, that there's an alternate construct in terms of what is supposed to be valued by the society. It's like, well, no, we don't get that. So just keep doing what you're doing. Good luck.
Unless you're telling everybody to go to Princeton, Princeton doesn't want you to come talk at Princeton.
Right.
What a shock. Right. It's almost like it's self-serving or something. I don't understand why that would be the case. It's totally illogical, actually. You also wrote a book called The Anti-Fragile Boy. Who's that book for, and what's the central thing you want a father, a teacher, or a mentor to walk away understanding after they read that book?
Some of it is just what we talked about earlier in terms of people understanding the difference between resilience and anti-fragility. And that there is that capacity. And instead of when kids fall down, making things easier for them, that we actually teach them that the things that have happened to you can be used as a source of fuel and as a source of strength. So it is for teachers, mentors, parents. And you know, I made it short enough and simple enough that if there's a teenager who's like, what's this whole concept about? Because I do plan to introduce it to the boys in at least one of the prisons, it's for them too to understand that concept of anti-fragility. So they said, so you mean all those things that have happened to me, I just don't have to absorb as trauma and then use it as an excuse for why I'm screwed up and not accomplishing anything? It's like, no, you're supposed to use those things to both grow and to contribute. And so that's the message that you know, anybody picking the book up should get.
And again, folks, that book is called The Anti-Fragile Boy. I'll make sure that it gets added to the show notes for today's episode. If you're watching the video, right down under the video some text, and at the very beginning of it, there's a link, and that link will go over to the audio side on my blog where all the resources will be, including Hans's website and things like that. But if you click it right now while we're still live, it won't work because we're not done yet. It'll be about 30 minutes after the live wraps up, but I will make sure that that link gets put in there for you. You also used a term I really liked, become an ancestor worth remembering. I heard you say that about 10 minutes ago. I sum that up as making the most of your dash. That's how I've always described
exactly.
it. Yes. Someday we're going to lay to rest. We all have a terminal illness called life, and they'll put a little dash between the year we were born and we died, and that dash is us. And I think it's a very noble goal. What kind of brought that to the forefront for you? I find that's not a thing that we think about when we're 20. It's something we think about as we age and we become more in touch with our mortality and realize that we all have this finite bit of temporal capital that's going to burn out at some point.
Right. And it's the dash, and it's, you know, planting trees under whose shade other people will be able to, you know, enjoy themselves. And so, you know, people may not remember me 5 years after I'm gone. That's fine. But for my North Star and my guide, if I'm living the kind of life where I'm at least, quote, worth remembering, then I know I'm doing the right thing. Regardless of whether anybody in fact does end up remembering me, and that's a touch point. So whether it's, you know, figuring out the next job or the next grant I'm going to write or the next relationship I'm going to be entering into professionally or otherwise, is this moving me closer to becoming that person, that ancestor worth remembering, or is it just keeping me, you know, running in place or even worse, having me fall back?
We're also here, the survival podcast, right? So, we talked a lot about a lot of things today, but one of the things we talked about on the show is the concept of like a survival instinct and how that can benefit us or be a detriment depending on how we use it. Like being motivated by fear can be beneficial because if a car is going to hit you, get out of the way. But if you overreact to a harmless snake, you could fall into a ditch and get hurt actually bad. Like you have to balance that. What does survival instinct look like in young men who grew up without the tools to channel it well? And how do you then redirect that energy rather than suppress it? Because it's not a bad thing. It's just widely misapplied.
Right. I mean, a lot of it is they've been taught that they need to hurt the person across from them first before they get hurt.
Sure.
And so some of it is them having a realization that not everybody's, number one, out to hurt you. Number two, you need to move in circles where that's not the major concern. And so how do you pick your friends? How do you pick your associates? How do you pick your spouse so that you're not facing that kind of peace? But then also, what are productive ways that you can channel that desire and need and instinct for survival into ways that are not only helping you grow, but the people around you feel better? And there's nothing wrong with letting them know that if you're the kind of man who has that survival instinct and you're putting it into positive community growth, people are going to look for you because you are so rare. And it's, they may not tell you this, but you're the kind of person they want as a central focus of their community. And they're going to want their children to be around you because you're the one that's going to be a protector. I've got one piece that I'm trying to bring into my program that I'm getting some pushback on. So I've got a, among other friends, I've got a retired Marine colonel, Iraq war veteran, who's also a combatives expert. And one of the things I'm saying is that these boys need to learn how to fight with their hands, right? And be like, they shouldn't learn how to fight. They need, no, you're emasculating them if they don't know how to fight. And if they don't know how to fight with their hands, they are then going to default to the knives and guns that they get locked up for. So, you know, any young man needs to be able to defend themselves, to defend their community. And what better way than, you know, having a Marine combatives instructor teaching them? And, you know, of course, you can put in Brazilian jiu-jitsu if you want something, you know, a little less aggressive and forward. But that's the whole concept. But it's been interesting to getting the pushback. But again, the people I'm getting pushback from don't have to live in communities where that's an issue. They live in gated communities. They're surrounded by police. And in some cases of people that I've talked to, by private security, so they don't have to worry about that.
You know, and I've noticed that people that train in combat arts, whether it's traditional martial arts like karate or judo or jiu-jitsu, or whether it's like a boxing thing, or even like Krav Maga or something like that, generally don't cause trouble with other people.
Right.
Like, right. I went to a lot of martial arts tournaments in my youth, and the only fighting was with pads on with judges. Like, people did, like, all the shit that's in movies were like, you know, like Karate Kid or whatever, where they're beating each other up in a locker room or whatever. Like, you know, or the, remember, like, the old Bruce Lee days with the dub movies we used to watch when we were kids?
Oh, yeah.
You know, my master is Master Cho. He's better than you, Bob. And, like, and then they would, like, just, like, try to kill each other. Like, that's not how that works. People that actually train in combat arts end up being very parasympathetic, as we were talking about earlier, and they're very chill because they know they can handle themselves, so they don't feel the need to prove it. And if you want to prove it, then we have a sanctioned, safe, relatively, mm-hmm. there's always injury. You can get injured playing football or basketball, so there's always injury, sure. but you generally don't have two people killing each other on a mat. You have a judge, right. you have a rule, you have a fail-safe, and then this male energy, because there is a strong desire in men to test their mettle against other men.
That's right.
And no That's amount right. of singing dinosaurs or any of that other bullshit will That's right. ever make it go away. It cannot be suppressed, so it has to be channeled.
That's right. No, that's absolutely correct. And it's you know, you're giving me more inspiration to keep pushing this point, because I was about to give up on it, saying, you know, am I going to lose these potential funders because they don't get this one piece? But I do think it's, you know, hearing this from you, it helps me to understand again how critical it is to that kind of personal development. And sense of security, and again, it's another option, right? They have options for when they have to fill that space if there in fact is a threat.
Yeah, and I, you know, I'm just back to, like, it's never the kid that goes to the jiu-jitsu class 4 days a week that experiences the discipline of a teacher who won't let them be an ass clown that ends up in these positions. It's always the people with no structure in their life. So if lack of structure is the problem, then it is just possible that just maybe the implementation of structure would be the right step towards a solution. But what do I know? I'm just a redneck hippie duck farmer. If someone is listening today and they're raising a boy, they're coaching youth, they're working in a school, they're doing this type of work, whether on a small scale or a large scale, formally, informally, what is the one shift in approach that you think would make a biggest difference for them, like starting now?
Pick out small challenges where there's a decent chance for that young person to win. Too often we try to avoid challenges and keep them away from young people, and unfortunately, particularly boys. So look for those challenges, and it can be a 10K race. It can be a jiu-jitsu tournament. It can be a debate competition. It can be a survival experience where they're going, you know, that includes a 1 or 2 day solo. It can be creating a vegetable garden for the community. But look for challenges where, you know, there's a chance of failure. But on the other side of it, there's also a chance of accomplishment and the ability for that young boy to say, you know what, I actually can do this. I don't know anybody else who is. And again, that's part of that whole positive self-esteem, not just, you know, everybody gets a prize.
It's kind of the balance of finding a thing that there's no legitimate reason that the person who really tries this thing can't do it, but not easy. It would be easier not to. So you're giving them, you're handing them a pre-designed win, but it's up to them to take on the effort to gain that win. Because I think that's a lot of these young people, I don't think they've ever had a win, not a real win. Right. They've had a score or something like that, but not like a win that they could be proud of. And not just with their boys or whatever, but be proud of publicly. I did this thing. And I find that people that never had that win, when they see somebody else getting a win like that, they're resentful.
Right.
right? Why is he getting like what? He must have had it easy, you know. He must have kissed somebody's ass, or if it's a chick, you know, she must have slept her way to the top, or whatever it is. Because otherwise, I have to look inward, and that's a really ugly thing if I'm not working on myself yet.
That's right. That's right. I couldn't have put it better myself. Yeah. No. That's structuring it that way, and they're not those kinds of opportunities that are presented in society.
Hmm. I think that there's something inside of all people that's amazing. It's just that some people never get the opportunity to find it. And that's what you're helping them do, is find that super human that's inside. We all have somebody inside of us that's like that, but many of us never come in touch with it. We never find it. And then the longer we go without that, the more we feel like it can't possibly be there. And then I think the biggest problem these folks have is they feel worthless.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, again, having that sense of purpose and belonging, those two things are critical. And then how do you do that? And there are not enough people looking to provide those opportunities to young people. It's what we were talking about before. We're going to measure you based on college acceptance, not even college completion at this point, but college acceptance, and we're good.
Well, let's talk a little, let people know about your website that you have as well. I'm not going to try to pronounce that word. I'm pretty decent with Spanish, but I'll probably butcher it. I'll try it. Currencial.
Currencial, yeah, perfect.
Oh, okay, perfect. All right. Yeah. I had to go back to the trade.
And most people aren't familiar with the concept of currencia. I actually had somebody who said he wants to donate a 5-figure gift just because I used the word currencia. And the reason is it's a word that's out there, but I use it because it's from an Ernest Hemingway novel, Death in the Afternoon. And it's the place in the bull ring where the bull goes and knows that no matter how poorly the bullfight has gone, this is the place where it's strong, where it can regain its composure, and where it knows everything is going to be okay. So I'm working with young people who I want them to find their own currencia, and know that, you know, not only and in this case, they're not only just standing alone in strength, but they're going to be other people that have gone through that same path. To do that. And that's part of that program. And that currencia, yes, ties into being anti-fragile.
Huh, if I would have just looked on the website, you actually have it phonetically right there. But I did it from real remembrance of the Spanish alphabet.
Much better than most people I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
My big dream, Jack, is again to have this cross racial lines, because I think this is incredibly important. And you know better than I. I mean, you saw the camaraderie that can be developed in for instance, during military training. And where are those other opportunities to do that kind of stuff through challenge? And I want Currencia leadership to be that kind of a place.
Yeah, we don't need a black solution, a white solution, a Hispanic solution. No. We need a solution. We have young people problem. The problem's not different. We just view it differently. In other words, we see two young people that both ended up in the same place for doing the same thing, and we judge the problem differently because of how they look. That's the bigger problem here. Human beings do the same stupid shit for the same stupid reasons over and over again, and there just may be more of one particular group, especially in certain regions, that fall into that failure-level demographic. But I can take you places where you would have a hard time finding anybody that wasn't whiter than me, and they have plenty of problems just like we're talking about. But we see that problem differently. But I think with men, and we've hit on it a few times today, the biggest problem that young men have is there ain't no old men in their lives. Right?
Not at all.
I know I needed it, and I didn't have it from my parents. I was lucky. I had grandparents that were young. Both of my grandfathers were prior service military, World War II vets. I had great uncles, and I had, you know, great uncles that were actually familiarly great uncles, like brothers of grandfathers.
Right.
And then I had good uncles, like uncles and aunts that were in that tight family, because I was a problem. I was the edge of a problem that never crossed over because I had enough cups to the head to not make that step. I had the old elephants around me willing to freaking hit me with a trunk or a tusk when I needed it. And that needs to come back. And if that young person's missing that, then someone has to stand in for it, or you're going to deal with the problem then, or you're going to deal with the problem when it's much worse. right?
That's right.
The best time to look for peace is before the war. Like you were talking about your kid, you know, doing the firefighting thing and all. The fire marshal doesn't want to put fires out. He wants to prevent fire. And so when these kids are young and you're starting to see the warning signs, in some places you don't even need a warning sign. You just know this place is going to produce a large number of people that are going to fit this problem in the future. We could do something about that. But I do think there's people that see that as like, if you are investing in prisons, that's your pipeline. Like they're literally looking at how many kids are in school now and where they're in school to figure out how many cells we're going to need 20 years from now. That's a sick society, and it may be a rough road, but if we don't do it, who will?
Well, and I think it's incredibly almost an existential question, because again, if there's a growing proportion of men who are either just completely sitting on the sidelines or worse, that as a country we're in a lot of trouble, and you know, defaulting to people who have that generational wealth instructing us as to how we're supposed to live. And that's not a world that I want to live in, and it's not a world I want my children to live in. You know, and I've got some decent men that up in New York, as I mentioned, this retired Marine colonel. I've got a retired NYPD sergeant, some other people in law enforcement, including some of my former students, one kid with two deployments, Iraq and Afghanistan, who was I had suspended this kid. And he came to my house the same day I suspended him in a snowstorm, saying, "I got kicked out of my house for something else." He says, "Can I stay over here?" He goes, "I know you're angry at me, right?" This is a kid I had to drive down to Paris Island, you know, so he could become a Marine, right? And he's a family man. He's married with two kids, running a company, and it's you got to have people out there making those kinds of efforts. Otherwise, again, as a country. Not just the communities I live in, but as a country, we're in trouble.
Seriously, I agree with that. So let folks know how they can find out more about you and how they can get involved and help you out with the work you're doing.
Yeah, CarenciaLeadership.com is one way. I have an app called ForgeAI.coach. People can take a look at that. It's my personal coaching app that I've gotten some good feedback on that I had mentioned earlier. And then, you know, my name, Hans Hageman, connect with me on whatever the platform is, LinkedIn or, you know, I got to say it, TikTok or Instagram. I'm around. I'm easy to find, which is good news and sometimes the bad news.
I did find your Facebook profile and put that in the notes, but I'll look up some of those others. And so, folks, all of those things will be in today's show notes. Hans, thanks for being with us today, man.
Well, thank you, Jack. I'm coming out for one of your events, by the way. Just me and my son. We're gonna do that.
Please do, man. All right, man. Take care.
All right.
All right, folks, real quick before we wrap up, want to remind you that you can help support the show and the work that we do by doing your online shopping where a little website called tspaz.com. Hard to forget. T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. You go there. No matter what you buy, you'll help us out. And I got an item for you that I think many of you will find seasonally appropriate right now. Is gardening season, the garden's in or the garden's going in, depending on where you're at. Mine is, I've got pepper plants 2 foot tall already, because down here in the South, we can start early. But that means you need to irrigate things, and you also need to wash things and stuff like this. We need hoses. A garden hose, to me, is one of those things that we don't see as an investment that we should. And it's a perfect example of where you need to look for a good price-to-value ratio. I've been recommending the same daggone hose now for about 12 years. It's made by a company called Gilmore. It's the Gilmore Pro Commercial Hose. They're available on Amazon. I have a write-up on the website today, both at tspaz.com and just the survivalpodcast.com. It'll be right under this episode if this episode's been published by the time you're hearing this. They make them from 25 to 100 foot long. I've thrown away so many hoses. I've had so many breaks, so many shatter. I've even had some of these get damaged by a wife that doesn't respect hoses when she rides the lawnmower. So I've just simply spliced them back together because they're worth doing that with if that happens to them. This is something I really recommend when you're going to buy a hose, buy quality. I would tell you this brand, the Old Craftsman brand, if you can find them, they're still really good. And honestly, there ain't many that are really great anymore. And that's why I recommend what I do. And you can find all the things that I recommend, all the products and what have you that I've reviewed, that if I wouldn't recommend them to you if I would spend my money on them, again, at tspaz.com. Also consider becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Member Support Brigade. We have great discounts that will more than pay for your membership if you'll just use them. I get people all the time, I didn't really use the discounts, I just joined the support. Use the discounts. That's how I get to keep vendors, and that's how I get more vendors, and everybody wins that way. And that's how you get to support me with no out-of-pocket real cost. So you can learn more about that at thesurvivalpodcast.com/members. With that, I appreciate everybody tuning in today. This was a fantastic guest. This guy, in my book, is a hero, and we need more people like Hans out there solving problems. Specifically, this problem we talked about today, the lack of mentorship in our youth, the recidivism in the criminal justice system, the desire, honestly, I think their desire is to maintain the status quo versus actually fix the problem. There's money in the problem as long as the problem's not too big and it doesn't get in the way of what they want. So we need people doing that, but we need people taking this proactive approach to solving problems in 100 different ways or more right now. And I just challenge you today, whether you help Hans out and get involved in something like he's doing or find your own thing, find one thing in your life. You don't have to be full-time in it, but you can dedicate just a little bit of your time every week, every month to trying to make a little bit better. We get a few thousand people doing just that, we can make a hell of a difference together. Thanks for tuning in today. I'll catch you tomorrow with an expert counsel Q&A show to round up the week. You should have a house the American way. Dollar down.